Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Frank, the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and most recently, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. He's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal and is the founding editor of The Baffler and a monthly columnist for Harper's. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Frank.
It's great to be here.
And your new book is a very welcome, warning, clarion call here that it deals with this extraordinary paradox, which has sort of troubled me for some time, and I've never been able to find a real answer to it. And I guess it goes back to when Obama first came in, the left, which would normally be the constituency that were outraged at what happened over the Wall Street crash and the subsequent bailout, they did nothing, while the far right, the Tea Party, stole all of that anger and disgust at what happened on Wall Street and ran with it and formed the Tea Party and took over the Congress in 2010.
That's exactly right. That's the book, man. That's what it's about. It's about how, you know, how the left completely missed this moment, and it was instead captured. Public anger was just completely swiped by the right after the financial crisis and the bailouts. I mean, this is stuff that should have been, I often say, a T-ball moment for the left, you know? It should have been an easy home run.
Well, but there was a signal, though, and I don't mean to discount all ideological credibility with the right, and particularly with the Tea Party, who I think quite fairly have been captured by political pros like Karl Rove and Dick Armey, and funded by the Kochs. So arguably that is a astroturf movement, although perhaps it did start out as a grassroots movement. But I think what's pretty clear on the record was that the first top vote for the bailout of Wall Street, it was the Republicans who overwhelmingly rejected that bailout.
That's right. That's right. Now, my view is that was not their alternative. Was not very responsible. I mean, what they were proposing we do instead would have been, you know, I actually went back and looked this up, and it would have been like this, you know, a disaster in like eight different ways. But at least they had, you know, they were able to come out of that debate with this a morally sound position that they were against the bailouts. And that was, you know, that's been their ace in the hole ever since. They opposed it. Now, they opposed it. The grounds they opposed it on were these sort of, you know, that bailouts are a violation of free market principle and government should never get involved in the private sector and, you know, and that sort of thing. And that's not the same reason that I, you know, oppose the bailouts. But nevertheless, you know, they came across in the early days and still come across today as, you know, as they're in the right place morally on that issue.
So why? So I guess the argument then would be, Thomas Frank, that at that point was when the Democrats and their new leader, President Obama, should have explained why they have to drink this poison.
Yeah, exactly. And they never really did a very good job of that, especially with the bailouts. You know, it was the bailouts, of course, were first instituted, you know, under George Bush and Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, both of them conservative Republicans. And when President Obama got in, he accepted their bailout strategy and vowed to continue it, and did. He basically accepted it completely. Made it his own policy, you know, took ownership of it. And he, I think, thought that this was very high-minded and statesmanlike and bipartisan. And, you know, even though it was a tough, you know, it was an unpopular thing to do and it was an ugly situation, you know, it was, of course, it was very popular with the banks, with the people that fund that funded President Obama's presidential campaign last time around. It was very popular with them, but with the public, it was despised. And I don't think that he or his people ever really figured that the Republicans would be, or that anybody, you know, on the right would be able to use this issue against him, because the bailouts had obviously been started by George W. Bush. And were they ever surprised, you know, when the right came along and said, oh, George W. Bush, not a real conservative? It turned out to be the easiest thing in the world for them. They just pitched George Bush overboard, took about 10 big paces to the right, you know, just kept moving to the right and said, you know, we've got to double down in our commitment to free market theory, you know, to having some kind of pure free market regime. And then, you know, you wouldn't have things like bailouts. And all of this, of course, and this is what makes it so deeply ironic, the kind of thing that just makes you want to, you know, bang your head on the table. They did all this after this financial crisis that had been brought on by deregulation and getting government out of the picture and letting the banks do just whatever they want. And now they're you know, you look at their presidential campaigns, you know, there's in the primary states, you know, these guys are all swearing to outdo one another with how much they're going to deregulate and how they're going to, you know, how much they're going to whittle back the regulatory state. It's amazing.
Well, just on trying to figure out why Obama dropped the ball on this. My understanding is, one, you mentioned it, Thomas Frank, that he took a lot of money from Wall Street. I believe in some of the meetings with the Wall Street bankers, Obama said, look, I'm the only guy between you and an angry mob. A lot of good that appears to have done him. Do you think that had Obama instituted a kind of PCORA-like commission that FDR did and campaigned against these giant banks from day one, it'd be a different situation today?
It definitely would be. By the way, they did do an investigation of the financial crisis. This is it wasn't Obama. It was Congress that did it. But what he could have done differently, and this is something that, by the way, I didn't even know about at the time when all the bailouts were going on in 2008 and 2009, and I didn't figure this out until I did the research for Pity the Billionaire, and I was digging back, and, you know, I wanted to look up the history of bailouts because I wanted to see if this had ever been, you know, how this had been done in the past and how people had reacted. And sure enough, it turns out that our government bailed out banks big time in the 1930s, and the program started under Herbert Hoover, and it was extremely unpopular for the very same reason that bailouts were unpopular this time around. I mean, there was rampant cronyism. I mean, it was sort of extreme. What happened was Hoover appointed the guy who had been vice president under Calvin Coolidge to run his bailout agency. Okay, so he's running the bailout agency, and then all of a sudden he quit, went back to Chicago, his hometown, and resumed presidency of a local bank there and immediately demanded a bailout. And he got it, right? And the public was furious. You know, this is the guy that was the head of the bailout agency. It was getting bailed out. You know, and they were, and this is while, you know, of course, people were starving and there was, you know, people were, you know, unemployment was sky high. And I believe the teachers in Chicago at that time hadn't been paid for 2 years or something like that. No, something crazy like that. And Franklin Roosevelt, far from saying, oh, let's do the statesmanlike thing and just accept Herbert Hoover's bailout strategy, he did the opposite. He was highly critical of it. You know, and he's for reasons that are very obvious today, because it was cronyism, because it was, you know, it was helping out the people at the top, the Wall Street banks, rather than the people who needed it most. You know, it was leaving Wall Street in charge of the economy, all of those things. And he kept doing bailouts when he was president, but he did it in a very different way. For example, when they bailed out a big bank, they would often fire the management, you know, and for really good reason. If a bank requires a bailout, you know, something has gone wrong. You get rid of these guys. We never do that now. He would bail out. He would cap executive, you know, salaries. You know, no bonuses like you had at AIG. No bonuses for the perps. You know. And, you know, just right down the line. But they took great pains to let the public know that they were not, you know, going to just, it was not just going to be business as usual. They weren't just going to stand Wall Street back up and let them get going again. They were going to regulate these guys. They were going to break up the big banks. You know, they were going to fire these guys. All of those things happened back then. This time around, none of it.
Well, in your conclusion to your book, Thomas Frank, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, the conclusion, Trample the Weak, you say, moneyed interest understand that with no second FDR, no incorruptible new cop on the financial beat, no return to the rules that once made banking boring but safe, they have nothing to fear from us and may do as they please. This is the real tragedy of the Great Recession.
That's right. I'm speaking about the lost opportunity there.
Yes, yes.
I mean, the fact that these people destroyed the world. They, you know, they drove the economic world over a cliff, and we didn't punish them. They didn't get punished by our political system. And so why not just do it again? There's nothing to fear for them. I mean, there's nothing political to fear. The situation is totally under control. From their perspective, the only, you know, real protest movement that you saw for three whole years after the crash happened was the Tea Party movement, which is explicitly about deregulating these guys even more and letting them do whatever they want, just as long as they don't get a bailout. You know, and Occupy Wall Street is a movement that I have a lot of hope in. You know, and I really like what I've seen so far, but they didn't show up for 3 years. After the initial crisis.
And they have no legislative agenda. They don't want to get involved in electoral politics, unlike the Tea Party that got to, 60 to 70 members elected.
That's right. And, I mean, that's just the beginning of the sort of disparity. I mean, the Occupy Wall Street movement is just getting off the ground. They'll be lucky if they have, just one or two legislators that proudly identify with them, whereas the Tea Party movement is essentially in control, you know, of the House of Representatives now.
So, Thomas Frank, your new book, Pity the Billionaire, gets into why the punditry got it all so wrong. And the conventional wisdom was that after George W. Bush and the disgrace of crony gangster capitalism, the left would come back and that the right would retreat and lick their wounds. And that the punditry, you say in the book, you know, believed back in 2008 and 2009 that the right needed to moderate itself back to the center. Well, guess what? It's the Obama White House that's moved back to the center.
That's right.
And the Republicans have moved way to the right.
Exactly. And this is something that you could see coming way back when it was starting, that the pundits were all saying, you know, oh, they have to, the GOP has to become moderate. They have to stop listening to people like Rush Limbaugh. They have to see that their economic program has failed, and their ethical claims gave us Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff, you know, this sort of thing. It was just like the pundits looked at this at the George W. Bush presidency. Remember how unpopular he was in the last days, and they said, you know, this is a political movement that is in ruins, and if it's not in ruins, it ought to be in ruins, and they just sort of logically assumed that the pendulum would swing back the other way. The idea that the Republicans would do the opposite, that they would swing hard to the right and come back to us as a sort of purified, you know, even more intense free market party, that possibility never occurred to anyone back then. And that they might be victorious by doing that, wow, you know, that's the thing that's just... I have a lot of fun... pointing out how wrong the pundits were, you know, 3 years ago, and I guess that's sort of shooting fish in a barrel, you know. But it's one of those incidents where the conventional wisdom just completely failed. And you know, one of the reasons why is that what the pundits didn't understand then, and I think they still don't understand today, is that, you know, they all live in Washington D.C. this sort of bipartisan world where a partisan world, I should say, where you've got the entire universe is defined by these two political parties. And it always, to them, it always seems like the course of wisdom is to move to the center. Always. You know, if only we could just come together as a people. And the Democrats, by and large, hear that message. and heed that message. And so you have guys like Barack Obama who thinks that it's, or you know, apparently thinks that partisanship is like the worst thing afflicting our nation. Not, you know, epidemic financial fraud, you know, or economic collapse or anything like that. No, it's partisanship. That's the real problem in America. And what's always interested me is that the conservative movement, they don't care about that. They don't care about the pundits, you know, the problem of partisanship or anything like that. They want to get what they want. You know, they're out there to win, not to, you know, please the pundits. And, you know, they're not about, you know, moving to the center and holding on to their jobs or something like that. They're about getting, you know, their historical mission accomplished. And that's what they did.
Well, surely, though, Thomas Frank, they've been helped, the Conservatives have been helped immensely by the Citizens United decision. You can see what's happening now with these super PACs. Now, admittedly, they're beating up on, you know, Gingrich and other Conservatives have been the victims of it. But it's no question that it's helped, and it certainly helped in 2010.
Yeah, and it's completely changed the way elections are being done. You know, the job that Romney's backers did on Newt Gingrich in Iowa was, I mean, it's really amazing. It was just, they just dumped money on this guy. They just smothered him with money. And it's also very amusing the way Newt Gingrich is fighting back now. He's running these TV commercials. I don't know if you've seen them, but they're like to the left of anything I've ever heard from Democrats in my lifetime, or they seem to be. I mean, he has a kind of, but technically he has nothing to do with it, right?
It's a billionaire friend who's put up for money. One billionaire. That's the point of our Citizens United. You know.
Exactly. No, money is so much more important, and it's also funny that you know, we think of ourselves as you know, we're a nation of individualists. We're a nation of people who think for ourselves. You know, and we go out there and we make our decisions based on what we see with our own eyes. But then you look at it, and the money translates directly into votes. You know, more or less. I mean, there's lots of examples where that hasn't worked out. You know, but that's sort of what's been going on in these Republican primaries. And by the way, the role of money in the Tea Party movement is not negligible. You know, money played a huge role in getting this thing off the ground. Things that got me interested in this is I went to what I believe was the very first Tea Party rally, although they, of course, argue about that among themselves, who was first, you know. But it was in February of 2009 in the park across the street from the White House. And it was largely a product of the sort of your traditional Washington, D.C. conservative establishment, you know. Newt Gingrich's group was out there. Dick Armey's group was out there. A couple of other libertarian groups were out there. Grover Norquist's group had some presence there. And then a bunch of sort of conservative movement celebrities were taking turns speaking through a bullhorn. And that was it. That was the beginning. And it took off from there, which is extraordinary, you know.
Right. Well, we missed the interview that we were going to do about try and answer the question of what is Obama going to do about the enormous vote he got from the young and the anti-war Democrats in 2008, which seems to be being captured now by Ron Paul. I guess that's a discussion for another day. You can only scratch your head at the fecklessness of the Democrats. But
oh my God! I try to get into that topic in Pity the Billionaire, but you're exactly right. It's just, I mean, I just wonder at that. You know, right. How do they manage to screw it up again and again and again?
But do you think, though, Thomas Frank, that there's a psychological component here to what's happening to America? It sort of reminds me of a political version of the Stockholm syndrome, where you begin to identify with your torturer. That the power of the right, the Republicans, unleashed by Citizens United, their domination of the media is such that it seems to be that they've literally beaten the American people into submission.
Yeah, I think there's something like that going on. I think that's about right. I don't know if I would. I'm not sure which syndrome I would go with, though. But it is definitely the case that people believe or seem to believe in a kind of hallucinatory, make-believe world, imaginary world that is more convincing and more real to them than everyday experience. The than what they actually see in the newspapers. I'll give you an example from yesterday's Wall Street Journal. Had a big interview with Rick Santorum, very interesting interview. The headline on it was, Supply Sider for the Working Man. You know, is there such a thing? Can there even be such a thing? Mm. You know, and how does the working man have any interest in supply side politics or supply side economics? It boggles the mind. But I'm very interested in that subject as well. And there's a whole chapter of Penny the Billionaire about the kind of psychological retreat that people do nowadays, where they are able to wall themselves off from the world. They watch Fox News, they read, you know, certain websites and not others. They don't read a general interest newspaper. They live in a neighborhood filled with people just like themselves. And they, what really intrigues me is that they believe in a kind of utopianism, a utopian worldview, which you didn't see just 5 or 6 years ago would have been, seems very strange, but today is everywhere. And the utopianism, of course, is free market. You know, if we just can reach some kind of Ayn Rand world where every, you know, where government is completely out of the picture, you know, it will be this sort of utopia.
Well, that suggests that Mitt Romney's got a good chance. And you warn here at the end of your book, Thomas Frank, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, that it could be a new, more ideologically concentrated right that gets their hands on the rest of the machinery of government. In other words, what we've seen with the Congress and their scorched earth tactics, if they take over completely, to my mind, it's the end of anything that resembles an American left. Of course, once again, the progressives and liberals are deluding themselves that Obama's got a shoe-in. You know, they woke up one day and Ronald Reagan was president. They woke up another day, George W. Bush was president. We could wake up in November and Mitt Romney could be president.
I wouldn't count him out. I mean, he seems kind of bumbling and silly at the moment, but you know, there's a long time between now and November. I mean, the other ones seem even more preposterous, right? I mean, President Santorum, President Gingrich, it seems impossible.
But President Perry, I mean, he's a guy
who
if we should reinvade Iraq, and that. Urinating on dead Taliban is something that he's defending now.
Oh, I mean, he's standing up for that, is he?
Yes.
Oh my God! That guy is just a nonstop laugh riot. Mitt Romney is very polished. He makes a really good presentation. You know, I would not count him out in November. It seems like it's not a good idea to do that, especially since this movement has discovered that they can, you know, speak to hard times anger that's out there in the land. That's the most critical development here. I mean, all my life, my leftist friends assumed that if you ever had some kind of replay of the Great Depression, you would have this sort of instant return to 1930s-style politics. And you did in a sort of superficial way in the last couple of years. This, you know, the Tea Party movement looks and sounds like a hard times protest movement. But everything, all the politics of it have been turned completely upside down. So you have, you know, and in the book I make a lot of noise about, you know, one of my favorite comparisons, that these guys with their laissez-faire utopia are very similar in a lot of ways to 1930s era Communist Party members. You know, they had their utopia,
sure.
And they claimed to speak for the producer class and had this vision of grand strikes, changing the world, like in Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, you know.
Well, Thomas, just in the last minute, do you think that a one percenter could be elected in spite of the 99% movement that the Occupy has done? I mean,
he could if you never made an issue out of that.
Right.
But that's up to the Democrats. We'll see if they can do it.
Well, it does seem extraordinary that your book indicates how successful they've been so far. And again, the Koch brothers captured the Tea Party. There's no reason why they're one percenters, so they can do it writ large, surely.
Exactly. 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 And you know, you need to pity Mitt Romney. They're doing such, they're saying such mean things about him. You know,
right.
You need to pity the billionaire.
Well, on that note, I thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Frank, the author of the new book, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle of the and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. He's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal and the founding editor of The Baffler and a monthly columnist for Harper's. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Mark Perry, who has an article at Foreign Policy False Flag, which reveals how Mossad agents posed as CIA officers to recruit terrorists who killed Iranian soldiers and civilians. This is just a small part of a bigger picture, which we really went into in depth about frictions between the U.S. and Israel, the possibility that the Republicans working with Netanyahu, who despises Obama, could cook up an incident that might help elect Romney. That is always a subtext. After all, they pushed the National Defense Authorization Act, which the Democrats signed onto because AIPAC owns both the Democrats and the Republicans on Capitol Hill. That is the precursor to what's happening now with tensions rising, the possibility of war through miscalculation. Since the Iranians feel that cutting off their revenues from oil is an act of war, this is what's happening now. The Israelis apparently tried to by killing this Iranian scientist. They were trying to sabotage talks that were happening in Turkey between the U.S. and Iran over walking back from the brink. So it's difficult to understand exactly how far the Israelis want to push the envelope. But Mark Perry's revelations of how they posed as CIA officers in Baluchistan, the extent to which they put American lives at risk and screwed up our relationship with Pakistan, which of course is pretty bad to begin with, indicates a kind of recklessness, if not ruthlessness, that is certainly worth exploring. And of course, the long and the short of it is, it's pretty clear that Obama doesn't want a war, but he may get one in an election year. And at the very least, the price of oil will go through the ceiling. So that is the subtext. Now, the second half of the program was with Tom Frank, this wonderful writer who's written this new book, Pity the Billionaires, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. We had a very interesting conversation. I mean, the book is so beautifully written. He's a really fine writer. It's a very important book in the sense to explain this, and how come the right captured the outrage over what Wall Street did in 2011, and the left has been sitting around, can't even get their narrative together, except for the Occupy movement that doesn't want to translate its activities into politics in any case. So I think it's a primer and an important book that everybody should read. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. Where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.